This is part 11 of our series, and it's actually part 4 of our examination of the model called Christ in Paradox with Culture, but it's better known as Two Kingdom, or what I call New Two Kingdom Theology. I don't want to call it radical, because that would maybe shut off any discussion with someone who actually holds to these positions. But the real question in this whole series, on earth as it is in heaven, when we pray that every Lord's Day as a congregation, do we really want and do we really expect God's will to be done right here as it is in heaven? And the real question is, how does our heavenly citizenship relate to our earthly life? If you're united to Christ by faith, then you've been regenerated by the Spirit, you've been baptized, you've been brought into God's family, adopted as a son or daughter, justified freely by His grace, all these wonderful benefits. And we know that according to the Scriptures, that those He foreknew, He predestined, those He predestined, He called, those He called, He justified, and those He justified, He glorified. So someday, glorification will be past tense for us. So as Don Running used to say, so what do we do now? Last week I looked at two biblical problems with new two kingdom theology. Let me use the whiteboard that Dave Gangwer so ably built a stand for. This thing could actually support about 18 whiteboards. It's so heavy. What is this? Ash? White pine? No.
Yellow pine.
I was going to say. That was my next guess. Elm.
Ripped out of a tuba can.
Okay. See? Nice corners, kids. Be careful. Okay. New two kingdom theology. Now, this is a bit of a review, so bear with me. They have Jesus as Lord over the entire universe. He rules the universe, however, in two different ways. Over here, we have what's called the common realm, or the civil realm, or you could even say the secular realm. He rules that by general providence, by natural law. It's what we all know to be true. He rules this realm, which is the spiritual or redemptive realm, in a different way. He rules both. He's not absent from one, but he rules that by revelation, by his word. And in this realm is generally found the institution of the church, with the proclamation of the gospel, the right administration of the sacraments, church discipline, the things that go on. And I'll go like this when I'm describing the redemptive realm, because I'm pointing upstairs to where our sanctuary is. And even that's a misnomer, to be honest. It's no more sanctuary, that's temple language. And so, without reviewing the entire thing, last week we looked at one of the biblical problems. They have an argument from silence. Where in the New Testament do we find a mandate to take over culture? Well, there are some assumptions that are bound up in that question in the first place. And it's supposed to be this big argument from silence. And we looked at that about 3 weeks ago. If you want to review, it's all on our website. My argument from silence, and again, I take this from Brian Matson's series, On Earth as It Is in Heaven, so this is his argument, but I think it's very good. Where in the Bible do we find a common realm? One that is neutral? I mean, how many times have you heard me or John or Nate say, there's no neutral ground. It's either Christ or the devil. It's an antithesis. You know, there's always a conflict, right? The two kingdoms in the Bible, if you were here last week, you can just shout it out. The two kingdoms that the Bible describes are the kingdom of
darkness
and the kingdom of
light,
exactly. So in the Scripture, when we have these two realms that are mentioned, it's always in these very stark, black and white, good, evil, light, dark categories. And so what the new two kingdom guys are doing, in my estimation, they're attempting to insert a third realm, and we talked about that way early on, this is really not two kingdoms, it's three. Because now you have the kingdom of light, kingdom of darkness, and in between the two, we'll put the kingdom of darkness is way over here. We don't want to draw it. It's not a fit thing for Christians to discuss. But over here, in the middle, is this common realm.
Kingdom of gray.
Kingdom of gray. That's right. And where in the Bible do we find this? Where the Bible describes Jesus' reign as all-encompassing. Remember all the passages we looked at last week. Psalm 2, Psalm 110. He must reign. Philippians 2, the Carmen Christi, the hymn to Christ. It is so overarching, the theme in the New Testament. When it picks up, and I mentioned Nate's series from Matthew, which we're still in, but I think this was back in the late 19th century when you were... I'm kidding. But pointing out the connection, Jesus sits on David's throne. What's the fulfillment? As excellent. David's throne. When the New Testament picks up the theme of David's throne, it's always in... There's no equivocation on how much of the universe the heir of David would rule over. And it's universal, it's all-encompassing, it's holistic, it's everything, it's every atom, and that doesn't leave room for... when you say in heaven and on earth and under the earth, that does not leave very much room for something not included in those realms. And so where the Bible describes Jesus' reign as this comprehensive unity, this theology divides it into two realms with differing concerns and administrations. I don't see that as arising from the text of the Bible. Yes?
Do you think it would be accurate to say that the 2K guys see Christ's lordship over the common realm as being anonymous as opposed to being by name?
One of the things that came up last week, and Mark asked a question about it, is the idea that in the common realm, Christians and non-Christians, believers and unbelievers, come together and work out their problems without special revelation. So one of the problems that we looked at is that as Christians, we don't bring anything unique from our Christianity into the common realm. And that's where the whole conversation with Doug Wilson and David Van Drunen arose from. Kind of an extrapolation. So are you telling me, and the guy actually said yes, it's usually when you go, I can't believe he answered yes to that. So, yeah, kind of, yeah. So today I want to look at a couple other biblical problems. New Two Kingdom men see the transition from creation to recreation as absolutely cataclysmic. There's no other way to look at it. Cataclysmic. My son's band, the Great Flood Catastrophe, comes from this just a utter wiping out. Annihilation. God's original creation, according to these guys, is and was always destined for destruction. Now, let me just say this. All Reformed thinkers have something regarding Genesis 1 and 2 as Adam and Eve looking forward to something better as signified by the tree of life. Okay? It's not that they were there thinking, oh, this is all there is and all there... It wasn't like they were little Carl Sagan saying, this is all that there is and all that there ever will be. Actually, they did look forward to something. But number 2, signified by the tree of life. But in this view, moving from one realm, the natural order, to the eschaton, the final situation, entails the complete passing away of the natural order. And David Van Drunen, the author that has popularized this view in the last 10 years, probably the most responsible for its resurgence, he writes this, quote, "The New Testament teaches that the natural order as it now exists will come to a radical end and that the products of human culture will perish along with the natural order." That's number 3 in your handout. Now, he cites many texts, and I know we don't have time to go into them all. But let me just say this. Many of the texts that he cites are texts that the Bible uses. When the Bible uses them, they are metallurgical. Okay. Metallurgical. Big fancy word. John Thompson, can you tell us what metallurgical means?
No.
Okay.
Metals?
Well, back in the mid-80s, you would have asked me what metallurgical means, and I would have... Marshall amp, loud... Okay. Different metal. It has to do with metal. And in the Bible, when we see these metallurgical analogies used, like the refiner's fire, what does a refiner do? He takes the raw ore, and he heats it to a great temperature until all the gunk, the dross, comes to the surface, and he scrapes it off. And some people make driveways out of that stuff because it's all it's good for. And you end up with pure silver. So, blacksmith's forge, heat and fire and purifying and winnowing. And these are all descriptions of the final judgment that the Bible uses. But I would think that those would be the last set of passages I would want to use to describe a cataclysmic, radical end of the natural order. They don't speak of annihilation. They speak of, in fact, I think those passages speak a lot clearly to what we would believe, and that's transforming. You're taking this impure, yucky, you know, worthless metal and getting all the crap out of it, all the sin, all the decay goes bye-bye, and what you end up with is pure gold or pure silver. It's transformative. So that, I have a problem with that, with those analogies. Metallurgical, and number four, don't speak of annihilation. They speak of transformation. And Romans, and I want to look at his handling of Romans 8, especially this section, verse 20. If you want to turn to Romans 8, around verse 20, 21, this area. Remember, Paul says that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. All right. So, and this is, Romans 8 is so rich. Can we spend a year in Romans 8? That would be so good. And this is David Van Drunen again. Here's what he writes about what I just read. It says, this, when creation groans for something better, for the glory that is coming, creation is not seeking an improvement of its present existence, but the attainment of its original destiny. Okay, that's okay so far. And what is its original destiny? He goes on. It longs to give way to the new heavens and the new earth, spoken of in 2 Peter 3 and Revelation 21. It longs to give way. So there it is. The liberation that creation is groaning for is the liberation of euthanasia. It wants to be put out of its misery. Paul just told us in Romans 8:21 that creation longs to be brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Creation groans. It wants to be brought into freedom and liberation. When we're brought into freedom and liberation, our sin is forgiven. And this purifying process begins in our lives. The longer you go on with Christ, the more you realize you've got cobwebs that need to be dealt with. In Isaiah 55:12, it says, you will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills will burst into song before you, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. And I just can't help but think, is David Van Drunen saying that bursting into song and clapping your hands for your own imminent demise is what we're hearing here? And I don't believe Paul is teaching the destruction of creation. He's teaching the liberation of creation, the freedom of creation. That's number five on your handout. And there's something very dualistic about the view of creation having to be utterly wiped out. There is a sense in which, if you look at the passage of 2 Peter 3, new heavens and the new earth, but it's what that means. And are we necessarily bringing in unbiblical assumptions to think that creation is going to be utterly destroyed? And we'll get to another analogy real quick that I want the kids to help me out with. And I think if this dualism, remember we talk about trying to be charitable to people, and you know, if they say A, B, and C is true, and our minds work really quick, and we have this thing that leads us to, well, if that's held, then ultimately you're going to have to also believe X, Y, and Z, and that's error and heresy and bad stuff. Well, I believe if that dualism where, you know, all creation is utterly destroyed, the physical universe gone, I think you're going to have issues with the resurrection of the body. Now, Van Drunen is an Orthodox Christian. He does not believe in some Gnostic world where everything physical is bad. And after all, our body is a result of creation, and it says in Romans 8 that the bodies, that's what we're looking forward to. Let me turn there myself. Paul says in verse 23 that we also await the redemption of our earthly bodies. So this is what David Van Drunen will concede. This is what he's going to allow for. He says this: our earthly bodies are the only part of the present world that Scripture says will be transformed and taken up into the world to come. And is he getting this from the text we just read? From a text that speaks of the whole creation's liberation being brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Compare the two statements. What Van Drunen just said, our bodies are the only part of creation that's going to be brought into the world to come. And what Paul just said, all creation groans to be liberated, to be freed from death and sin.
So Tim, how does this stack up with 2 Peter 3? Or is it related at all?
Yeah.
Within 2 Peter 3, but...
Right.
Orthodox specifically, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought we to be to live in holiness and godliness, waiting for the hastening and the coming of the day of the Lord of God?
Right.
Because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells.
Is that an ESV translation?
Yes,
there?
Yes.
Okay. Not that it's going to be the battle of the translations. That day, which is the judgment, bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat, but in keeping with this promise, everything will be destroyed in this way. It's going to depend on what that is actually saying as far as, is it purifying the heavens themselves? Do the heavens need purifying? There's something judgment language about this. It would be totally recognizable to someone familiar with Daniel or Ezekiel or Isaiah, where you talk about, you know, fire and burning and purifying generally. So whether the elements will be destroyed by fire, heavens will disappear with or so. Even if you take Van Drunen's logic and apply it even to that, even our eternal destiny, the out there part of the end time, even that's destroyed. Something's going on there where there's a sweeping,
I'd say also that something to bear in mind, like we just heard from Matthew, what's, you know, the notion of the stars falling from the heavens, and
right,
whenever you see the heavenly bodies being destroyed or falling or whatever in Scripture, that is often a reference to worldly powers as opposed to literal physical entities.
Yeah.
So what Peter's talking about there could be the judgment of the worldly system itself coming to an end, so that the powers that be that are in opposition to Christ will once and for all be destroyed, and then you have a new heavens and a new earth that is free from corruption, free
corruption
from the corruption of those worldly powers, also free from the corruption of death as well.
Right.
Because we know death will be destroyed. So it doesn't mean the annihilation of creation itself,
right,
per se, but it means a
And I would just say this too, that we want to make sure that we're not reading into anything here other than what the point that Peter's making is. And I remember Roland Jump saying this years ago, anytime you read about this kind of judgment and stuff, it's always connected with, here's how you ought to be living your lives in light of God's, not just his prerogative, but the eventual judgment.
Hey, kaboom.
You don't want to be loyal to those powers who are going to be passing away. Be loyal to Christ.
Let's look at another analogy that he used. I don't believe that if we're going to look at Romans 8:21 and draw from that text that our bodies are the only thing that make it through the judgment, I don't think that arises from the text. And the implication is that creation and recreation are in complete discontinuity with each other. You know, there are some things about the new covenant that are like the old covenant, but there's a lot that's not like the old covenant. In the same way, creation, recreation, there are things that are like the creation. We have trees and rivers and, you know,
critters.
There are critters, and there are you, and there is you and I, as well. There's another example that they use, and that's the example of the flood. If you want to look at 1 Peter 3, just turn back a passage here. And again, we believe in tota scriptura, sola scriptura. Take all of the text together. 1 Peter 3:20, speaking of Christ, through whom he went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. Now we'll just stop the reading there. And Van Drunen uses this text and says, as a foretaste of the last day, the flood indicates that the products of present human culture are doomed to destruction with the natural order itself. So, rightly, he's referring to Peter's use of the flood as a paradigm for the coming judgment, and the flood destroyed everything. So, kids, are you with me? All of you, ages don't matter. So, was everything destroyed in the flood? You can say it.
Not everything.
No. Vince says not everything, but Van Drunen says the flood is a paradigm and everything in the created order is going to be destroyed. What made it through the flood, kids? Huh?
The ark.
The ark. What was the ark made of?
Wood.
Wood. What is this wall made of? I'm not saying this is the ark. But the ark was made of good, solid 1970s paneling. Welcome to Paneling World for all your paneling needs. Right. What else made it through the flood?
Dinosaurs.
Birds didn't make it.
You're saying it.
Animals.
Animals, right. And aren't animals part of the created order? Animals. That's right. What? Who else made it through the flood?
People,
Noah and his family. So does the flood point to a radical discontinuity between creation and recreation? I don't think so.
You don't have to destroy something.
Does the flood point to a cosmic, absolutely?
Oh yeah, it was cataclysmic.
It was cataclysmic.
Right. And to what Dave's saying as well, and this is number 6 on your handout, the flood is not an example of total annihilation. It's an example of God's gracious preservation and redemption of the created order, even in the midst of judgment. Now, that's not necessarily a pretext for transformationalist model or transformative, but what did God do? He took out of what he said, I'm going to destroy everything because the wickedness of men has reached such a tipping point that I have had it. But yet, Noah found what in the eyes of the Lord?
Favor,
or New Testament word, grace. So when first, huh?
But the difference between the flood and the one coming is there's sin remained.
After the flood.
Right.
Right.
One coming.
Right. God took care of that.
One coming will be...
What, 1,800 years after that?
No sin will remain.
Yeah, 2,000 years ago, in God's providential timing, that's where he takes care of sin. And what's the last enemy to be defeated someday in the future?
Yeah.
Death itself. Well, so it is a process, but at the flood, if you're going to say the flood is the paradigm for this radical getting rid of all material created stuff, I don't think it works, because you have created things coming through the flood.
Jim, it goes back to what you were saying about the metallurgical aspect of it. You can take a bar of raw steel, which is useful for some
yeah.
life, and you can put it through a blast with fire and hammer and, you know, bigger hammer type of thing, and when you get something out the other end, it's usable, it's functional, it's beautiful, and it's without dross that,
right.
That has
right.
been essentially hammered out of.
Yeah,
could be an iron.
That don't work, get a bigger hammer.
Yeah, and you could make guns out of steel, or you could make bridge supports. You can do good or evil with creation. So in the process of the new heavens and the earth, there's no more of that evil stuff. It doesn't exist. John, you wanted to...
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's another purification, obviously, not a complete, you know, destroy everything.
Right.
Start with new molecules. It is,
right.
Let's wash away the world with water instead of with fire.
That's right. Yeah, the next time, I'll never flood it again. Next time is fire. Everyone say, oh, whew, that's good. Won't get the flood again. That water, oh, man. Okay, let's look at one more text this morning, Revelation 18. This is one that Van Drunen, I think this is a real, I mean, if you didn't think I thought the previous two were problematic, I really think this one's problematic. So in Revelation 18, you have this vision of the utter destruction of Babylon, which these guys take to symbolize as a picture of the final judgment. Now, let's just leave the date of writing of Revelation. Just for now, let's leave that over to the side. And what the Babylon is in Revelation 18, I think we have some pretty good idea what that symbolizes. But let's leave it that interpretation for a moment. The text says that all of the city's culture is destroyed. Its economic markets, its wealth, its power. Remember, all the kings of the earth did business. It's not personal, it's business, right? This is all about making money and trade and commerce and luxury and power. And Van Drunen likes to remind us that these kind of activities are things that even Christians participate in. This is what he says. Listen, like the Israelites that left their houses and gardens behind in Babylon to return to Jerusalem. So, remember the exile? You've been in Babylon, now I'm bringing you back to the land. But they left a lot of their stuff in Babylon so they could come to Jerusalem. So believers today await the time when they see destroyed the activities and products of human culture to which they themselves contributed, and they are welcomed into the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven. So there's the analogy that he's using. Israel in exile in Babylon, return to Jerusalem. And when they leave there, they leave everything in Babylon behind, and Revelation 18 is teaching the destruction of everything left behind, including the series left behind. I don't believe that the Babylon in Revelation 18 is describing a situation in which Christians are participating. I don't believe this is describing a common realm. Here's why. This Babylon in Revelation 18 is the absolute enemy of God's people. Number 7 on your handout. It's the absolute enemy. It has set itself up against Christ and His church, His people, His bride. This Babylon hates you and I. They don't want to work with us in the common realm in this Babylon. No. They worship the beast. These Babylonians bear the mark of the beast. They make war against the Lamb. They drink the blood of the saints. Babylon in Revelation 18 does not represent Van Drunen's common realm. It represents the apex of evil. the kingdom of darkness in its fullness. That's number 18. It represents the kingdom of darkness in its fullness. It's the apex. It's like the paramount wickedness. In fact, in verse 20 of Revelation 18, it says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you." Saints. I don't agree with his interpretation of this at all. I don't think it holds, passes muster. There are other interpretive issues too we could go into, but suffice it to say, Babylon in Revelation 18 is... Yes?
I was just going to say, to make that comparison ends the argument, because there's no way you can maintain that secular powers are neutral, because the Babylon in Revelation, as you just stated, is clearly not neutral
That's
for Christ at all.
Yeah.
In fact, that's that leads me to the next point. The other irony of using this text is just what Nate said. The city is being destroyed because it's an enemy of God. So what happened to this neutral realm being allegiance neutral? Remember, your ultimate commitments are sort of irrelevant in the common realm. Because remember, it's believers and non-believers alike. We all participate together. You don't apply the law of God to the civil realm, according to these guys. It's natural law.
Secret Jesus.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah, this is the last passage I would muster to support a common realm. The whole thrust of the passage is to say that culture is in no way neutral. It either submits to the King of Kings or it makes war on the Lamb. It's either or. It really is as stark as that. And it's a good stark, because you can see, as I hope we all do, you can see the great, wonderful benefits and blessings when a people follows Jesus Christ. It's like the country song starts working backwards, and you get your wife back and your kids and your dog comes and you don't drink anymore. All of a sudden you sober up. It's like that's what happens when yeast works through the dough in a culture. People love Jesus. They learn to love him instead of their sin. And remember, people are condemned not because they didn't get opportunities, condemned because of their sin. This is the issue, sin and death. And if you look just three chapters later, we are told that in the New Jerusalem, this is in verse 23 of Revelation 21. Remember, this is where we're going someday. We're not there yet. Got a lot of work to do. The glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. And then in verse 26, the glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Let me ask you this. When the kings of the earth bring their splendor into the New Jerusalem, what do you think that splendor is? I mean, any idea? It's love of God. Could it be all those cultural artifacts that have been purified of sin?
Yeah, there's a cultural beauty coming out of those different nations that are refined, and you're still left with that diversity of beauty.
Right.
Those nations.
If you want to look at how our Reformed forebears considered the artistic endeavors that were created by non-Christians, highly recommend it. There's a few different resources. We talked about this a few years ago in the Christian and the Arts series, but by and large, when they weren't tearing down idols, which they at the time, I think they right to do, but they all appeal to, look, there's the Imago Dei is not entirely effaced. It still resides in people. They still create beauty, even though they're trying to push and suppress the truth of God away. They still have this. And when God purifies something, he takes all of the sin and wickedness, just like he does with us. I quoted Schaefer, what a shock, last week. When you become a Christian, all the sin in your life is put to the side. That gets, yeah, that we can annihilate. And everything else is spiritual. So rolling on the floor with your kids, spiritual activity. Attending church is a spiritual activity. Working well is a spiritual activity because you do it to the glory of God. In fact, Colossians says, whatever you do, in word or deed, again, that's pretty comprehensive language, do it all in the name of Christ or is it the glory of God. It's all to be subsumed under His Lordship. And Van Druden declares that this honor and glory and splendor is just their worship and praise. I just don't understand why there's this aversion to anything material being carried over, being transformed. And there's a book that Bill Yorka, he's my book guy for the last 5 years, I think. But there's a book by Francis Nigel Lee called The Central Significance of Culture. And he does a great job. He was a South African Reformed theologian, tying together the dominion mandate in the garden all the way to Revelation 22 and how it all works together in this purifying sense of taking the good and having that rise to the surface by metallurgical analogies and all the rest of the dross, the idolatry, all that is totally annihilated. And I just don't believe that you're going to find from the exegesis of the passage. I think these anti-natural order creation sentiments are being read into the text.
Isn't this just old Platonic thinking?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a new spin on it.
Yeah. Nancy's asking, isn't this just another version of Platonic thinking? Platonic is where, you know, when we talk about a Platonic friendship between a man and a woman, it means they're like this. They don't intersect. They're just friends. My wife and I are friends, but it is not Platonic. So in other words, it's not this radical separation where down here it's just the drudgery of material things. And up there, though, are the perfect forms of everything, and the forms exist. And if you ever look at the analogy Plato uses, Plato's cave, which is not just a coffee house in Brooklyn, but it's an actual philosophy. Lord willing, next week I want to tie this part of the series together. Probably would be good to kind of review the idea of natural law versus God's revealed law, how that works out in the civil realm. Not to open up a big theonomy tote bag, but every Christian's a theonomist. We want everyone to be ruled by Jesus. So it's how that apply, you know. John, you want to say something?
I was going to say, it might seem like a nitpick or a small thing to talk about whether or not it's annihilation or transformation. You know, what's the big deal? But if it really does change the way people live every day, if I think every one of my interactions when I'm home privately and when I'm in the public space, when I'm in talking business, economics, politics, if I think there's some continuity coming out of those spheres of life, I'm going to have a different engagement in those areas. And those relationships, I'm going to say, those really matter. They're lasting generationally and on beyond that.
Yeah.
If I take the alternate view that stuff's just going to be totally annihilated and there are no traces going forward, they're not going to be invested in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
like
good.
It's more like I'm just waiting to blow up so I can get on with the real thing.
Yeah. You remember the old saying that what you do now counts for eternity or echoes in eternity.
Right.
So in a sense, they're saying, as far as your good works, again, somebody brought up, and I can't remember who it was a few weeks ago, what about when the unbelievers see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven? What, here? You know? No. It means, period, all over the place, at home, at work, at play, at school, any sphere that you have. And it will affect how you view that stuff. It really is. It's a it's somewhat of a watershed, and I think it allows some of these guys to appeal to mere pragmatism when it comes to this so-called common or civil realm, whatever works. And I, like I said, I've been doing a lot of research in this, reading the primary source men, as it were, the teaching, their primary source documents. And this is exactly what they're saying. They said that whatever works over here is fine. Yeah.
Oh, you're much nicer than I am.
Well, I'm a nice guy. I've heard that from Vince.
Because I think this is a bastion of cowardice. Because what it does is it liberates us from the responsibility of going toe-to-toe with the enemies of Christ in the civil realm so that we can hide in our churches and play it safe and not risk being persecuted.
And isn't it interesting that that's actually what the secularists at the New York Times have been saying all along? Oh, yeah, whatever you want to do in your church walls, that's fine. Yeah.
For now.
Yeah, what did Luther say? You can have all the soldiers and horses and machines of war, but if you're not lined up where the battle's actually being fought, then you might as well not have those.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so Lord willing, then next week we'll try to tie this part up, and then subsequent 3 weeks we'll try to make the positive case for the transformational model, Christ and culture. And then I don't know what we're doing after that. So, all right, let's be dismissed and prepare to worship.